everything that's been discovered about this universe, everything that exists, only because of the human brain. Now, we obviously didn't create the universe, but we discovered it. So the brain has become, I think, the center of the human anatomical universe. And that when it's with us, you're alive. And when it's not, you're not. I think there are overwhelming ethical problems. I'm not denying that at all. But to realize that an operation has been created to transplant the human thinking process, and some believe the spiritual process.
We now have separated the head from the body, which has been removed.
And this would probably keep somebody alive for a number of years after they would have died. I was probably a sophomore or maybe a junior in high school in Minneapolis. One of the things that was required in the biology laboratory was that you had to dissect a frog. The day's work required the student to remove the top or surface of the skull and display the brain and do as little damage to it as possible. And when it was all done, this red-haired Catholic brother came to my desk. I was petrified. And he looked at it and he said, "White, I've never seen a dissection as good as yours." I thought he was kidding me. And he was going to give me a clasp behind the ear. And he said, "You know, you ought to be a brain surgeon." Well, I became very fascinated with neurosurgery. So off I went. And it was a great experience. Welcome to my little abode. As you can see, it seems to be filled with papers, books, and photographs. It's where I love to retire to in afternoons and evenings. Now here, these two portraits that are up here may be of interest. This is Harvey Cushing, who was born in Cleveland, died in Cleveland, who began the field of neurosurgery. This is Nagovsky, who was a Russian pioneer in resuscitation and reanimation.
How many times did you operate on
the brain? Did I operate on the brain? Oh, I think about 10,000. I got to know it very well. Now here is a half section of the brain. This model is one of the best in the world. I mean, your brain looks like this. These are complicated areas. And whether you like it or not, that's you. You say you figured you'd be prettier than that. Well, kind of sad, isn't it, to think that you spend your life operating on something as goofy looking as that.
And so you do most of your writing in here?
No, actually, I do it. I do it at McDonald's.
Oh, you do?
Well, see, one of the reasons is this place is so close to the bedroom and the pantry and everything else, it's very difficult to...
Too many distractions?
Yeah. If I'm going to drive all the way from here and then drive all the way back and work at McDonald's, I better get something done. Let's see, I was graduated in about 53, I think. So I went to work at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital in Boston and as part of Harvard. So what I had entered was a general surgery residency. So here was an appendectomy. There was the surgeon, who was a senior resident, a junior resident like me. In the meantime, I'd had a chance now to settle back and look at this student nurse that was helping me. It was an absolute knockout. All of a sudden, the chief of surgery, a famous, famous surgeon, looked in the door and he said to the chief surgeon, "I need you." And he said, well, that leaves you, White. He said, "Well, if you have any trouble removing this appendix, just holler and I'll come back and help you." I did the operation. I met my wife.
The very young woman there on the couch is my wife, Patricia. And on her right is my daughter, Pamela. And still on the couch on my wife's left is Marguerite and Richard. And continuing along, my oldest son, Robert, and my son, Christopher. Yes. And then coming back here, the boy with the lovely hair is my son, Michael. And standing next to Michael in the blue shirt is my son, Jimmy. And directly to his right is my son, Daniel. And this is my youngest daughter, Ruth. And this is my oldest daughter, Patricia. I'm exhausted.
It was also the time, because I was there from 53 to 55, that the first successful kidney transplant was done at the Brigham, for which the Nobel Prize was given. Now, I didn't have anything to do with that, but yes, it was a very exciting time because they were thinking about liver transplants, they were thinking about heart, lung, I mean, they were really into it. Well, first of all, my thesis for my PhD was indeed a total hemispherectomy in the dog, where half the brain was simply removed. And then the animal was very carefully treated to see A, if it would survive, and B, what would be the neurological deficit. Now, at that time, and even today, they were already removing half a brain for two things. One of them was for epilepsy, and the other was for tumors. Some highly malignant brain tumors are subjected to total removal and removal of that side of the brain in which the tumor is embedded.
Yeah, here's your brain tumor. It's a malignant tumor of brain. I'm cutting across the tumor. So you can see it's solid inside, totally abnormal. There's nothing here to resemble brain tissue in any way.
The ones done on humans were often very less than that. They were really removing mostly the cortex.
How are you feeling today?
Not too good.
Not too good, eh?
No.
What is it, the food or what?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Can you put your arm up for us, Mrs. Galino, huh?
Yes.
Good. How about the other one?
But nobody knew how far to go. I mean, after all, you got to stop somewhere. So I designed this. It was approved at the Mayo Clinic and at the University of Minnesota. And I had to operate on these animals, had to take care of them. They did have animal technicians there. Well, we found out that this paralysis and so forth that would occur in these animals would clear up amazingly. And that for people who were not aware of which side the animal was operated on, could not tell you which side of the brain was removed.
The operations are done in a laboratory that's set up just like an operating room in a hospital. The reason for that is that we have to have the same sort of talents, the same skills to do the surgery and manage the anesthesia in these animals to keep them alive and properly pain-free as we would with even children when they're operated on. We principally use monkeys because their nervous systems are very similar to man. There are many people who have great sensitivities about the use of animals in medical research. And I can only remind you, I'm not trying to influence you, but I'm using your question as a basis, that the wonderful advances that we all enjoy in the field of transplantation, surgery, and medicine are a direct result of centuries of experimental work with animals.
No, give me a Diet Coke.
Diet Coke.
And a decaffeinated coffee. Well, one of the things that bothered me when I was at the Mayo's was I had reached a point where very often the emergencies, particularly the traumas, I was very disappointed on the results. I've been with a lot of families when members of their family were dying, and I could not save them. Individuals with spinal cord injury, for example, didn't seem to get better no matter how I operated on them or how soon I operated on them. And that's the problem. The brain of a human cannot be without a blood supply beyond 3 to 5 minutes at normal temperature. The brain is extremely sensitive to the circulation. And without it, it simply dies much faster than any other organ in the body.
Don't forget our heart. Our very life depends on the proper working of this amazing little instrument. Our heart is actually a little muscular pump, forcing blood through thousands of miles of blood vessels. Blood that carries food and oxygen to every part of our body. And of course, there's our brain, which in itself is almost beyond our ability to understand.
I guess God went to a lot of trouble just to make our bodies so perfect.
In other words, you've got to find some way to alter the demands of the brain. And the easiest and most scientific way of doing that is to reduce the temperature of the brain. And I thought to myself, well, look, I already got this wound in the back of this person's body to decompress the spinal cord. Why don't I just hook this up to an ice bath and a pump and simply circulate the ice water in and out of this cavity? So I went to work working out the limits. How cold could I get the brain? How long could I keep it cool? What sort of technique would I develop in order to do that? So I had done a lot of studying. I had done experiments on brain tissue and its responsivity to low temperature. I just felt that this was really the method or the system to treat injuries of nervous tissue. We worked out a force which would render the animal totally paralyzed if it wasn't cool. Obviously, they were receiving the best anesthesia that can be provided a child. We found that if we cool these animals soon enough, within 4 hours, they could become good enough to be running around the cages again. But we found, I think better than anybody else, that if you could get the brain temperature down, let's say to 14 degrees, that while you could close that artery off only for 3 to 5 minutes, you can now close it off for probably a couple of hours.